Macintosh Folklore Radio, written by Andy Hertzfeld and Company, and read by Derek Warren. Hello, everyone. It's Derek here, wishing you and the Macintosh a happy 25th anniversary. Today's story took place 25 years ago and remains the only story for which there is a video to accompany Andy's account. If you search for 1984 Apple Shareholders Meeting on YouTube, you can watch the hour-and-a-half-long keynote yourself, or, even better, shameless plug, listen to Retro MacCast episode number 102, where I join James and John to discuss the Mac's 25th anniversary. You can join the party over at www.retromaccast.com. Also, a special welcome to the over 100 new subscribers that appeared literally overnight, coinciding with the Mac's 25th birthday. Thank you for staying tuned. The times, they are a-changin'. January 24th, 1984. The big day had finally arrived, Apple's 1984 annual shareholders meeting. We had looked forward to this day for so long that it didn't seem real that we were experiencing the long-awaited public unveiling of the Macintosh. We were excited, of course, but also nervous about our hastily contrived demo software and still exhausted from the final push to finish the operating system. Over the weekend, I attended one of the rehearsals to help set up the demo, which was fraught with problems. Apple had rented a powerful video projector called the Light Valve, which projected the Macintosh display larger and brighter than I thought possible. But the Mac had to be connected to the projector through a special board that Burl cooked up to compensate for the Mac's unique video timings. The Light Valve seemed to be quite temperamental, taking eons to warm up and then sometimes shutting down inexplicably. Steve wasn't into rehearsing very much and could barely force himself into doing a single complete run-through. The software team usually arrived at work after 10 o'clock in the morning, but on the morning of the shareholders' meeting, we gathered in our fishbowl office in Bandley 3 at 7:30. We walked together to the Flint Center, half a mile away, arriving early. The cavernous auditorium seated up to 2,500 people, but it was already filling up and was soon standing room only, packed tight. The software team sat in the second row in a section reserved for Macintosh division employees. The lights dimmed, and Steve Jobs appeared at a podium on the left side of the stage. He was resplendent in a finely tailored black suit, complete with a prominent bow tie, looking more like a Las Vegas impresario than a computer industry executive. You could tell that he was nervous as he quieted the rousing applause and began to speak. Welcome to Apple's 1984 annual shareholders meeting. I'd like to begin by reading part of an old poem by Dylan, that's Bob Dylan. Steve flashed a big smile as he started to recite the second verse of The Times They Are a-Changin', stretching an occasional vowel in a Dylan-esque fashion. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changin'. He thanked Apple's board of directors individually for their support in a turbulent year, and then turned the meeting over to Apple's chief counsel, Al Eisenstadt, to run the formal part of the shareholders' meeting. Al ran through some procedural matters, and then introduced Apple's newly hired CEO, John Sculley, who summed up Apple's latest quarter. The quarter had seen disappointing Lisa sales, more than balanced by a fantastic Christmas for the Apple IIe, whose sales had more than doubled from the previous year. The crowd seemed distracted, impatiently waiting for the main event that was now imminent. Sculley appeared to sense this and hurried through the bulk of his presentation. He concluded by thanking Mike Markula and the executive staff for supporting him during his first few months at Apple, thanking one individual in particular. The most important thing that has happened to me in the last 9 months at Apple has been a chance to develop a friendship with Steve Jobs. Steve is a co-founder of Apple and a product visionary for this industry, and it's my pleasure now to reintroduce Steve Jobs. Steve reappeared on the left side of the stage as the lights dimmed once again. It is 1958, he began, speaking slowly and dramatically. IBM passes up a chance to buy a young fledgling company that has invented a new technology called xerography. 2 years later, Xerox is born, and IBM has been kicking themselves ever since. The crowd laughed as Steve paused. Steve had cooked up this spiel for an Apple sales meeting in Hawaii the previous fall to introduce the 1984 commercial. I had seen him perform it a few times by now, but never with as much passion, intensity, and emotion dripping from his voice. It is 10 years later, the late 60s. Digital Equipment Corporation and others invent the mini computer. IBM dismisses the mini computer as too small to do serious computing and therefore unimportant to their business. DEC grows to be a multi-hundred-million-dollar company before IBM enters the mini computer market. Steve paused again. It is now 10 years later, the late 70s. In 1977, Apple Computer, a young fledgling company on the West Coast, introduces the Apple II, the first personal computer as we know it today. IBM dismisses the personal computer as too small to do serious computing and therefore unimportant to their business. Steve intoned sarcastically as the crowd applauded. The early 1980s. 1981, Apple II has become the world's most popular computer, and Apple has grown to a $300 million corporation, becoming the fastest-growing company in American business history. With over 50 companies vying for a share, IBM enters the personal computer market in November of 1981 with the IBM PC. 1983, Apple and IBM emerge as the industry's strongest competitors, with each selling approximately $1 billion worth of personal computers in 1983. The shakeout is in full swing. The first major personal computer firm goes bankrupt, with others teetering on the brink. Total industry losses for 1983 overshadow even the combined profits of Apple and IBM. It is now 1984. It appears that IBM wants it all. Apple is perceived to be the only hope to offer IBM a run for its money. Dealers, after initially welcoming IBM with open arms, now fear an IBM-dominated and controlled future, and are turning back to Apple as the only force who can ensure their future freedom. Steve took an even longer pause as the crowd's cheering swelled. He had them on the edge of their seats. IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns at its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right? The crowd was in a frenzy, and the already famous 1984 commercial filled the screen. A beautiful young female athlete stormed into a meeting of futuristic skinheads, throwing a sledgehammer at Big Brother, causing the screen to implode in a burst of apocalyptic light. By the time the commercial finished, everyone in the auditorium was standing and cheering. Steve described the Macintosh as the third industry milestone product, after the Apple II and the IBM PC. Some of us have been working on Macintosh for more than 2 years now, and it has turned out insanely great. All this time, a lone Macintosh had been sitting in its canvas carrying case near the center of the stage. Steve walked over to the bag and opened it up, unveiling the Mac to the world for the very first time. He pulled it out and plugged it in, and inserted a floppy disk containing our demo software, which ran flawlessly. The Macintosh became the first computer to introduce itself, speaking in a tremulous voice.
Hello, I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't lift. Obviously I can talk, but right now I'd like to sit back and listen. So it is with considerable pride that I introduce a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs.
Pandemonium reigned as the demo completed. Steve had the biggest smile I had ever seen on his face. He was obviously holding back tears, overwhelmed by the moment. The ovation continued for more than 5 minutes before he quieted the crowd down. The rest of the meeting was an anticlimactic blur as Steve ran through some marketing material and introduced new versions of the Lisa. He played a slideshow tribute to the Mac team with voiceovers from the most important contributors. He turned the meeting back to Al Eisenstadt to announce the shareholder tallies and complete the formal portion of the shareholders' meeting. Every member of the audience was given a copy of the first issue of Macworld magazine, with Steve on the cover as they departed. Most of the Mac team hung around near the stage, congratulating each other, waiting for the crowd to disperse. A little bit later, after we returned to Bandley 3, we were surprised by a large Apple truck that pulled up in the parking lot near the back of the building. It contained 100 brand new Macintoshes, one for each member of the team, personalized with a little plaque on the back. Steve presented them one at a time to each team member with a handshake and a smile as the rest of us stood around cheering. We were so keyed up that it was impossible to get back to work that afternoon, but most of us didn't want to go back home either. The Macintosh was supposed to go on sale that very day, immediately following the introduction. I thought that it would seem more real to me if I actually could go out and buy one, so five or six of us walked to nearby Apple dealers. The first, closest dealer didn't have any units in stock and said they weren't for sale yet. But we didn't give up, and the next dealer was willing to sell me one, even though he didn't have any units in stock either.